just a reminder, and the two of you, of course, have been through this drill many times, so just a reminder to be sure to sign in the sign in sheets.
Yes, sir, we had that discussion out in the hallway. I was also reminded that we needed to speak up, and I assured her that that probably wasn't that admonishment wasn't necessary for me, at least. Well, I set aside 5 minutes, that's usually a futile gesture, but let's set aside 5, and I'll try to stay within 10 minutes on my opening remarks.
5 minutes, Mr. McCracken.
Thank you, sir. It's always a pleasure to be here. I'm Barry McCracken. I'm here from the Public Defender's Office in Norfolk on behalf of Jonathan Housie. Mr. Housie was convicted at Norfolk Circuit Court of failing to return rental property. The race in question was a 55-inch flat-screen color TV rented initially by Mr. Housie and his roommate on the 15th of May in 2013. Now, originally, it was Mr. Housie's roommate who was renting the television. But when it was determined that Mr. Claude, the roommate, had only lived in the apartment for less than a month, it was necessary to have a co-signator on the rental agreement, and the defendant was pressed into service. Now, the rental contracts listed him as the co-renter in one place. I think they referred to him as a co-signer in a different place on the various documents. The nature of the contract was it had a four-month term. The property was rented with an initial monthly payment. The next monthly payment was due on June the 15th. June the 15th rolled around, and lo and behold, Color Time didn't get his payment. And they proceeded to try to initiate collection procedures or return procedures. Interestingly, the contract didn't have an acceleration clause. There's nothing in it that said, look, if you don't comply, we can accelerate the lease term. It simply said we can attempt to recover possession. But the contract itself doesn't give them, gave Color Time no right to legally accelerate the term. The whole point of that was, of course, that they were expecting to get 4 months rental no matter what happened to the TV set in the interim. Whether they got it back or not, their claim was going to be they were entitled to 4 months rent because that was the lease term. The assignment of error here is that there was no, the Commonwealth's evidence did rise to the level of proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant harbored a fraudulent intent in the failure to return the rental property. Now, the Commonwealth relied on two different, to attempt to prove that critical element, the Commonwealth relied on two different things. One, they relied on the fact that at some point, according to the business records as interpreted by the owner of Color Time, and that's an important thing to note, the owner was the only witness to testify. He brought with him Color Time's business records generated from the computer, according to him, of all the records that were retained by Color Time in relationship to this transaction. He acknowledged that he was generally aware of the transaction, but he didn't participate in it. All of his testimony, other than he acknowledged that he knew the defendant from a past business relationship, the defendant apparently a year before or thereabouts had been an employee of Color Time. So he was aware of it. He testified from personal knowledge about that. But insofar as this transaction was concerned, he purportedly was relating his testimony to an interpretation of the business records. Basically, there was an entry that indicated that in a field visit, or at least he indicated it was a field visit, they had been told by some anonymous source that the two parties had moved on the 25th of June. Not that they moved on the 25th. On the 25th of June, they were told by someone that the parties no longer lived at the address on the rental contract.
And the two parties, one of the two parties included the defendant.
One was the defendant, one was his roommate, Claude.
So when you say that the defendant was pressed into service to sign as a guarantor, he actually was, he really was a co-lessee of the television. There was for use in
that apartment, and to a certain extent, certainly he at some point, there was no evidence he ever took any actual possession, and presumptively he was in the apartment, he had constructive possession. We really don't have any evidence of that either. But we do know that as of the 25th, based on their records and by their testimony, that on the 25th, the two parties weren't living together, at least not in that apartment. And we know from further information in the records that Claude had the TV and had control of the TV between the 25th of June and the 7th of July of 2013 based on their interactions. There was never any contact with the defendant after the initial rent on the 15th. Everything was either done, according to the owner, somebody hung a door tag on the apartment, but there's nothing in the records to reflect that the door tag was left on the apartment. That was his summation of procedure, but we don't have any evidence of that independent of his belief that that happened. He also indicated that certified letters were sent. Now, let me do a correction in my brief. In my brief, I indicated that he never identified the nature of the letter or the address to which they were sent, and that's somewhat misleading. On page 24 in the appendix, when he was, that's a cite to the transcript. On page 24 of the appendix, he was talking about certified letters being sent. He didn't say to what address in that testimony or what entry he was relying on to make that indication. Later, on page 27, he did look, and there are two facsimile letters in the file. They were admitted as part of the business file. And when he was testifying, identifying various business records, he did say, that's a copy of the criminal letter. And he said the criminal letters, in his mind, referred to certified letters. So I, to the extent that I said in his testimony he did not identify it, I didn't want to mislead the court. I was looking at one page of the transcript when he was giving his general narrative, not at the part of the transcript where he was going through the thing essentially page by page and identifying to the court what each page was. Now, it's our position, straightforward, setting aside statutory inference, that this case is no different than Burton. If you take a statutory inference out, and in Burton, that case I cite it as reference only, obviously it's an unpublished opinion, so we know it's not precedential. But there is a dearth of authority dealing with this particular statute in the Virginia case law, so we take what we can get. And the rationale in Burton is applicable here. If you take out the statutory inference created by 118B, there's simply no evidence of a fraudulent intent on the part of my client. Basically, the fact that his phone number bounced, and you know that Mr. Schaller, the owner, interpreted that to mean there was a wrong number, but bounce means transfer. That means it went to some other line. It doesn't indicate that it may have been to a different cell phone, it may have been to his mother's landline, he may have been on vacation in Hawaii. There's no way of knowing, but saying it went to a different number is not the same as saying it somebody told him on the other end this was a wrong number. That's not what the business records reflect. And that he had moved. Now, once again, we're crediting this unknown third party that supplied that information to an unknown party at color time. But assuming that was correct information, there's nothing nefarious about moving. We don't know why he moved. The roommates may have come to a parting of the ways. It may have been they couldn't come up with an adequate shared use of the color TV. We don't know. There's no evidence of that. Moving doesn't mean anything, and there's absolutely nothing in that contract that obligated my client to notify color time if his phone number changed or his address changed.
Had to have been an unusually short-term lease for the original renter to only be in the apartment for a month or so.
You can do week to weeks. I hate to say it, but this idea is that basically somehow it was unusual, and they rent hotel rooms on a week to week basis in Norfolk, and whole families live in there. So I don't know that you, I mean, we make these assumptions, but there was nothing about the contract that ever said if they were in a long term lease. They just had an address that they shared.
What about the fact that Mr. Elsie used to work for Caller Time, so he knew the drill. He knew when he signed that line, he knew what he was in for.
Well, he knew he was as a co-signer. If you looked at the way Mr. Shower explained it, it didn't really make it sound like they expected him to be anything other than a co-obligor, not someone who was actually co-renting. When you looked at what the owner's definition of how that was supposed to work, basically said, made it sound like he was second in line. If the guy didn't pay the bill, they expected him to pay the bill, but they didn't really give him possession of the TV set. And the one thing we do know from all the evidence, such as it is, that after the parties had moved, Claude, the roommate, had the TV. And remember, this is not about my client's failure to pay the bill. This is not a contract action. It's about his inability, his failure to come back to the color time and bring that 55-inch TV, and we know from all the evidence, he didn't have the TV. He might have could have come in and paid, but he couldn't have brought the TV, and by the terms of the contract, he wasn't obligated to pay off the full amount until the end of the term, and the end of the term wasn't in September, not when all this collection procedure was going on.
Well, when he signed as a guarantor, and I realized that would be on the civil side, he knew that he was signing one for the value of the TV.
Which was somewhat overstated, but that's not an issue either. Yes, sir. I'm not suggesting nobody's saying in these transactions that it's a defense that you're somewhat ignorant of the way these things work, so it doesn't make you any more culpable if you're aware how they're supposed to work. And that's what we have here. We have a lack of evidence showing a criminal intent on the part of Mr. Outsey. I would suggest...
So you don't think the fact that he worked for Color Time should at all be calculated by the trier of fact?
I think they can take it into account that he had been a previous employee, but in the scheme of this thing, look, he didn't come in and offer to sign as a co-obligor up front. He walked in and they said, hey, why are you here? Since you're the roommate, we won't let him have the TV unless you sign. Okay, he probably is aware of that procedure. Okay, I'm signing. And he signed, I would assume he signed with the same assumption the way he'd been taught. Mr. Schaller told you what he believed they were doing. The reason he was signed on it was not to make certain that there was an extra pack to carry the TV back in, but to make certain they had a second party to pay the indebtedness. I'm over my time, but let me make a couple more points and I'll try to save a minute.
All right.
This has taken me longer than I thought. It is my position that notwithstanding Schaller's testimony, the evidence does not establish an entitlement to use the statutory presumption, because the letters that are there, the postage sheets are there, do not show those letters are certified. The receipt does not show, they show an address, they don't show they were attached to those letters, and even if they were attached, the letter doesn't tell us anything because the method of service is not indicated on those postal slips. They weren't completed.
But there was testimony to that effect, wasn't there?
His testimony. And his testimony was based on the records. You know, he can't rise any higher than what he was looking at. Now, there is an entry that the AG very creatively pointed to that says CTL on 625, CERT ENT. He didn't say what any of that language meant, and we have no way of knowing whether that contains those letters or not. And there's no way to cross-reference that to anything. So what we have...
Is there a reasonable inference from the
the AG certainly thinks so, but I would dispute that. I don't believe keep in mind, most of what he said that was shown in the records was inaccurate. I mean, he talked about more contacts. He talked about numerous letters. And we got two, one to Claude, one to the defendant. They were talking about when this contract was due and when the TV, really they couldn't send that letter until September 15th. They sent it June 15th. Because the lease term wasn't up by the clear terms of the language. I mean, there are all sorts of, all I'm saying is he made a lot of, the owner made a lot of statements that aren't verified in the business record. And that's the same is true for those two, that for the one letter that pertained to Mr. Outsey. And I'm going to hold that 2 minutes I've got.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Kiernan?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Elizabeth Kiernan on behalf of the Commonwealth. In this case, we have a factual issue. Intent is a factual determination that was reserved to the trial judge who heard this case, and there is certainly evidence in the record to support that judge's factual finding that the defendant acted with the intent to defraud. We have the defendant's actions when he used a phone number that was not his correct number when it was, when the rubber hit the road to put on this lease. He wasn't at the address where he was supposed to be. And he made no attempt to contact Color Time to explain to them anything about these inadequacies. And this court has held on other occasions, most recently in Austin, that a failure to communicate regarding non-performance is certainly something to consider when we're talking about intent to defraud. Likewise, his misinformation provided on the rental form. The misinformation combined also with, as Judge Huff mentioned, the fact that he worked at Color Time before and knew exactly what he was doing when he signed that agreement and that they would be trying to get in touch with him. If, as his counsel argued at trial, and this was only argued by counsel because it was evidence, His roommate had taken the TV and had somehow absconded with it. He made no effort to contact Color Time to tell them about that. The manager testified at trial that to that day, he still hadn't spoken to him about where the TV was or what was going on with the two of them. Further, I don't think it's a fair inference to assume that the other renter had this TV the entire time. The owner testified that they haven't been able to make phone contact with the other renter, and that other renter told them places the TV might be, and that's on appendix page 21. They said the TV is over at this address, and it never was there, and they got kind of a run around from the other guy. But just because they were able to get the code signer on the phone doesn't mean that the code signer was in exclusive possession and control of this television. The defendant walked out of there with it. He didn't have to be there. There's no evidence that his co-renter showed up and then they had to call for backup to have someone else sign it. They were brothers. They were roommates. They listed the same address on the renter form. They're listed as renter one and renter two. The defense theory of the case, of course, was that he was kind of just the co-signer and was along for the ride and was taken to the cleaners by a bad roommate. But that's certainly not the only inference and the only theory that's supported by the record in this case, and the trial court was certainly justified in rejecting that hypothesis of innocence. There was no evidence to that effect put into the record. Although not
is this an entirely circumstantial case?
I wouldn't say it's, well, intent, Your Honor, is often circumstantial. Because you can't tell what someone is thinking, and this court has held before that circumstantial evidence can certainly be as compelling as direct evidence. So to the extent that we're talking about intent, I would say yes, it is a circumstantial case. The defendant didn't testify. We have no direct evidence from him as to what he was thinking, but there were reasonable inferences to be drawn from his conduct and also from the certified letters sent by Color Time in this case. And the record that we have is not extensive. However, I would not discount the owner's testimony. He testified, and that is evidence before the court. So when we say there is no evidence of these certified letters, we have live testimony, in-court testimony, subject to cross-examination regarding the certified letters being sent. Certified letters were sent. These were the letters that were sent, and we have the computer entries to back it up. They are not well. Things aren't spelled correctly. There's a little bit of shorthand going on there, but I think it is a reasonable inference, from the CTL certified letter search sense. The other abbreviations are similar, and I think the evidence before the court was sufficient to use that.
Even if the letters were omitted, is the testimony enough?
Yes, Your Honor. The trial court was certainly. There was evidence to support that factual finding. As we've said, his actions in knowing exactly what was going on with Color Time, not having the correct address, not contacting them in any way for the entire period up until the trial to work out a resolution to this issue, the trial court would have been justified, and in fact did, just rely on those things and coming to the conclusion that intent to defraud was here. This is a belt and suspenders kind of argument, if you will, Your Honor. That even if those were not enough, and that's certainly not our position, those certified letters would have provided evidence of a prima facie case. And this court, of course, can affirm on any basis apparent in the record. And there's there's ample evidence that these certified letters were sent. Briefly, this case is distinguishable from this court's Burt case relied upon by the defendant. In Burt, the numbers that were wrong and the addresses that were wrong were other people's addresses. It was other people's phone numbers that weren't going through. It was her landlord's cell phone number and not a landline. And those are things that defendant didn't have control over. And you can't draw inferences about the defendant's state of mind from other people's behavior. But in this case, we have the defendant's own address, the defendant's own phone number, and his own lack of communication with Color Time. And this is certainly distinguishable from Burt in that aspect. I'd be happy to answer any questions of the court.
Hearing none, we thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd ask you to affirm.
Mr. McCracken, all of your remaining time?
Yes, sir. Briefly, as to Burt, we're trying on point to take out the certification. The allegation in Burt wasn't that the other people had changed their numbers. It was that the defendant had provided false numbers and information about all his references. The allegation apparent here and the connotation put on it by the trial judge and her ruling was that the defendant had provided a bad phone number and a bad address. And actually the evidence we have doesn't sustain that, like I said, the information they received was that he had moved. Moving implies being there. Telephone number bounced. That doesn't show that it was a wrong number, doesn't show it was a bad number, doesn't show if they tried again, which they did not. Remember, their entire focus was with Claude. They sent my client one letter and hung up something on the door, according to them, that's not evidence in their record. And they made one phone call. And that was it. That was their entire effort to contact my client. It's because Mr. Claude had the TV set. And it's their records that reflect that he was the one telling them that he had the TV set and telling them where it was located. Basically, even if you assume the statutory inference might apply, my client's ability to move the television set back to color time can't be established. He apparently, at that point in time, was out of possession by their own records. What I would suggest to you is, A, the trial judge ruling is clearly erroneous. You could not, based on the two pieces of information they have, infer fraudulent intent. That is, that he had moved and that his phone number was no longer valid, or that it would at least had been forwarded at some point. Insofar as the statutory inference, the testimony that certified letters were sent basically was refuted from the file itself. There's nothing in that file that shows that the letter to my client was certified. Accordingly, that inference didn't apply, and accordingly, the government failed to meet its purpose. And if you had questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but I can tell by the look on your face that's not for it. Thanks so much for allowing me to be here.
Thank you very much. We'll step down and greet counsel and then take up the case of William Thaddeus Perry versus the Commonwealth.